From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Each year, the Eurasia Group details the biggest threats to peace and prosperity. Eurasia Group founder Ian Bremmer, in town tomorrow for the Baltimore Speaker Series, points out that countries are less and less able to detect, let alone prevent, a cyber attack. The weaponized hostility between President Trump's supporters and opponents will persist no matter what happens in next year's elections. And the rupture in trust between the world's two largest economies runs deep.
In the next month, Xi Jinping is going to travel to Mar-a-Lago, and there's going to be a deal that will be announced, and the markets will be happy, and a lot of headlines about how the Americans and Chinese are friends. But fundamentally, the U.S.-China relationship is broken.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The world is facing a terrifying array of risks. A fundamental break in trust between the U.S. and China. Increasingly sophisticated hackers, as we're all more digitally dependent. Despots around the world finding common cause with President Trump to chip away at global institutions. And more. Each year, Ian Bremmer, founder of the Eurasia Group, lays out the top geopolitical risks. He says the geopolitical environment today is the worst in decades, and yet he doesn't expect 2019 to be the year things fly apart. Ian Bremmer will be in Baltimore tomorrow for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. He joins us on the phone now. Welcome to On the Record.
Happy to be with you, Sheila.
Reading the top risks report you published less than 2 months ago, I felt you were describing a slow-motion car crash. At least 10 potential crises all heading in the wrong direction, and yet you write that 2019 might be a good year. Explain that.
Well, because they're not urgent. I feel as if I were an ecological scientist focusing on climate change 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, the science was there. We knew it was going to get worse, but no one's going to do anything about it because it wasn't affecting us immediately. And certainly when you look at what's happening to liberal democracies around the world, the political polarization, the us versus them, when you look at the rise of China in creating an alternative to the United States, both economically and technologically, and certainly not politically reforming to be more like us or accept our rules of the road. You look at Russia undermining the United States and Europe and trying everything they can to take advantage of divisions that exist in our countries. None of these things are getting fixed. None of them are getting better. But none of them are about to lead to a crisis tomorrow. It's more that when we do have the next crisis, our ability to respond to it is going to be so much less than what we've had historically.
You start your global risk assessment with a section called bad seeds. For example, you say President Trump has weaponized, your word, divisions between his supporters and opponents. And you say even if he does not win re-election, quote, American liberal democracy and accompanying values aren't what they were. No one can put Humpty Dumpty back together again, close quote. Is that sort of a picture of all these problems?
It is. I mean, it's a picture of a United States that is not in decline. We have the largest oil production in the world and food production in the world, and our part of the world is actually very stable. There's no arms race going on our borders, that kind of thing. But the ability of the United States to call the shots internationally, to get other countries to do what we want, that is so much diminished from where it was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And no, that's clearly not coming back, in part because we're not interested in taking up that role anytime soon. Again, in part because the Europeans are themselves so much more divided than they were, and in part because other countries increasingly have options. And that's a problem. It's a problem that's not going to be experienced by the average American anytime soon. I mean, you know, refugees don't make it to American shores. Terrorism is a much bigger problem in Europe and the Middle East than it is in the United States. And we don't have threats, really, from just across our border the way so many other countries do. And so we don't view it as something we need to particularly respond to anytime soon. But the rest of the world is heading in a much more dangerous direction.
About the U.S. and China, you write that the relationship, any fundamental trust between the U.S. and China is broken, and, quote, even a truce in the trade war won't fix it, close quote. Why should that keep me up at night?
Well, I don't want to say that things should keep you up at night, but why should you care about it? You should care about it because in the next month, Xi Jinping is going to travel to Mar-a-Lago, and there's going to be a deal that will be announced, and the markets will be happy, and a lot of headlines about how the Americans and Chinese are friends. But fundamentally, the U.S.-China relationship is broken. There's no trust between the world's two largest economies, and the biggest lesson the Chinese have learned over the last couple of years is that they don't want to be in a position where they are potentially dependent on the United States going forward as a consequence of that. So they have to build their own technology that is not reliant on U.S. supply chain. They have to have their own connections with other countries to ensure that they have political and economic influence that will maintain their own political stability. We're becoming less integrated with the Chinese. We're becoming more autonomous. And a world that has really expanded dramatically in the last 40 years on the back of U.S.-led globalization, where everyone was playing by the same rule set in the global economy, that is going away. And as it does, the ability of the American corporations to benefit from access to a single global economy is also going to erode. That will long-term affect our pensions. It'll affect our savings, affect our opportunities.
As I mentioned, you published this risk assessment the first week in January. Does the abrupt end of President Trump's meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week add another risk?
Not really. Actually, the likelihood of armed confrontation with North Korea is pretty low. Even though the summit didn't go well, the fact is that the North Koreans are no longer only talking to the Americans. They're talking to the Chinese. They're talking to the South Koreans as well. They weren't talking when Kim Jong-un was first leader. They weren't talking to any of these countries. And the Chinese were particularly angry because, you know, he killed the head of his military. He executed his uncle, who was quite close to Beijing. Now, suddenly, there's this flurry of constructive diplomacy with all of these countries in the region, including with the United States. And, you know, I don't believe that Trump is suddenly going to go back to his fire and fury rhetoric. I think that they are still going to look and see if they can at least maintain the limited progress they've already accomplished. But even if the U.S. decided they wanted nothing to do with the North Koreans, that improved China and South Korea relationship, which matters a lot more for the actual geopolitical balance of the region. That's not going away. That's much more stable. So I think we have less to worry about in the near term from North Korea, even though the headlines, of course, coming out of Hanoi were not very positive.
Korea's Kim does show up in your risk list as part of what you call the motley crew, along with Putin of Russia, Erdogan of Turkey, Netanyahu of Israel, and several others, who you say have an interest in working with Trump to undercut world institutions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's in a sense a coalition of the unwilling. They're not really trying to build anything new, but they all are taking advantage of the comparative vacuum, the absence of international leadership in the world today. Russia is doing that in the most obvious way in terms of their information warfare, their invasion in Ukraine, their propping up of Assad, who has now won the war in Syria. But there are lots of rogue actors and states that act similarly. And let's face it, they have a hard time when the Americans have a lot of strong allies that are all saying, you've got to behave in the way we want you to. The Americans are no longer promoting a lot of those values ourselves, and certainly our allies don't feel as strongly attached to doing everything the Americans say these days.
That's Ian Bremmer, founder and head of the Eurasia Group, here on The Record. He'll be in Baltimore tomorrow for the speaker series presented by Stevenson University. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about threats building for the U.S. and the whole world. Assessing risks is what Ian Bremmer does for a living. He founded and heads the Eurasia Group, and he's coming to Charm City tomorrow for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. Some of the worries on your 2019 list of top risks deal with technology. You say hackers are becoming more skilled, and efforts to head off cyber conflicts are, to use a term of art, a mess. Explain that.
Well, we do know that our ability to deter cyber attacks has been next to zero. Sometimes we can't even identify what actors behind them, and even when we can, our ability to come up with what we should do to retaliate has been pretty risk-averse and pretty concerned about unintended escalation. We also know that there are a lot of actors out there that are increasingly capable in terms of their cyber offensive capacity. The Russians today are more or less at parity with the Americans and what they can do to disrupt in their interventions in American critical infrastructure. The Chinese are getting more capable. They're less interested in undermining the Americans strategically, but they do engage in an enormous amount of theft of intellectual property and trade secrets on the part of companies involved in pretty much every sector. And then you have criminal activities coming from the North Koreans, coming from organizations like WikiLeaks and Anonymous and others. The combination of that with the fact that the Trump administration is trying to get more proactive and less risk-averse in how they respond means that the dangers from cyber attacks are one of the few things that I think actually do pop up, not just as an expanding risk, but also one that could really hurt us in the near term.
And does some of the other risks that you highlight in terms of how things are working together, does that make this one more difficult to address?
Like climate, you're talking about global challenges that if you wanted to address them effectively, you would need alignment and consensus from a lot of the big countries around the world. We don't have that. I mean, let's face it, NATO is feeling weaker than it was. A lot of Americans saying, why would we defend a NATO ally like the Baltic states if they were attacked by the Russians, even though they sent troops to Afghanistan to fight alongside the United States? You've got Turkey threatening to attack the Kurds while the Americans are there supporting them, though Turkey is a NATO ally. So NATO is getting weaker, and NATO is not really tooled up to engage in cyber defense collectively on the part of this alliance. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that the geopolitical order is itself unwinding and weaker and less resilient than it was certainly when the Soviet Union collapsed means that issues that are fundamentally global in their reach are going to be a lot harder to address. That means cyber. That means climate, and it also means the next major economic recession that the world has.
But you also point out that governments worried about security are shunning technical innovation and tightly regulating how citizens' data can be used. You call it a winter of innovation. I'm not sure I understand.
Well, in the sense that we now are increasingly closing off opportunities for cooperation and collaboration between the West and China. As you know, we've prevented Huawei, the major telecom firm in China that is probably in the lead globally in rolling out 5G in telecom, from investing in the United States. We're increasingly putting national security concerns around other sorts of collaboration and joint laboratories and AI, for example, between Western corporations and those in China. Now, that is perfectly understandable from a national security perspective, but it also means that the global marketplace for talent and the global marketplace for rolling out product is becoming fragmented. It's more limited than it used to be. And obviously, when you crack a global market in two, you don't get the same efficiencies of scale. You don't get the same investments into innovations and, you know, sort of big moonshots in technology. So that's what we mean by innovation winter. You know, you instead of having one global system where everyone's rowing in the same direction in technology, suddenly you have two very different systems that are competing.
And there are other risks that you've identified also. And I know you said your point is not to keep me up at night, but if you had to bet, which of these risks that you highlight do you think is going to be the one that we are really worried about or really hurt by in, say, 10 years?
In 10 years, I think that the two that I would focus on will be the fact that we will no longer have a single global free market. China will be the largest economy in the world, but they will be state capitalist. And as a consequence, they will be really competitive with the United States, and they will dominate a number of other countries in the world economically, technologically, and increasingly politically, which means that a lot of those countries will be more hostile and less inviting to American multinational corporations and American investment. I think that's probably the most significant thing, that the single country in the world of scale that is developing a long-term strategy as a government is not the U.S., it's not Europe, it is China. That's probably the biggest thing in the next 10 years. But the other thing that's increasingly really big in the next 10 years is the fact that climate change is starting to have disruptive effects to geopolitics on the ground. Africa, despite all of the benefits of globalization, bringing people out of poverty, getting them education, expanding lifespans, all the rest, Africa now has a larger number of people experiencing absolute poverty and food insecurity. That number is growing faster than Africa's demographic explosion, and it's happening almost purely because of the combination of bad governments and climate disruption. And in the next 10 years, you're going to have a lot of countries in Africa that are increasingly unlivable, with governments that are increasingly incapable of providing for their citizens, and those people are going to move. And the countries that they move to are not going to want them, and that's going to cause a lot of stress. Especially for the Europeans.
You commented on a poll that Gallup did about what people around the world think of leadership in various countries. Some of the findings were stunning. Essentially, the leadership of Russia, China, and the U.S. are all held in the same low regard. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, China's regard has increased in recent years from a lower number because they're spending a lot more money in those countries. And, you know, people like it when you write checks. The United States has been held in lower regard in the last few years. A part of that is the Americans not wanting to do as much internationally. And a part of that has been the reaction to the America First policies and character of President Trump. Some of that certainly can bounce once Trump is no longer president in 2021 or 2025, but some of it is structural because, I mean, under any president, I don't see the United States doing a Marshall Plan in the near future. I am a little surprised that the Russians are at roughly the same low level because, frankly, they're offering very little to the international community, and they've largely been a disruptive force in decline, and people don't like losers. They usually like winners. But Putin himself has been seen as doing better. Certainly he won, quote-unquote, in Syria. He won, quote-unquote, in Ukraine. And so part of it is, you know, his image as a strong man who's been there for a long time is well known, is translating to some level of popularity.
Thanks for this conversation. I look forward to seeing you in Baltimore Tuesday.
It's going to be much more upbeat in Baltimore, I promise you. We're not just talking about risk. But thank you very much.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, will be at the Baltimore Speaker Series tomorrow night. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have a link to the Eurasia Group's list of top risks 2019 and also a link to their wonderful puppet regime.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.